Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm with my co-host, Frank Cagliano, as always. Frank, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine, David. I'm a little tired because I was up all night watching the election returns here in the UK.
Yeah, it's a kind of a historic day yesterday and morning this morning. We had the Comey hearings broadcast here, I guess, all afternoon, Scottish time, and then the UK snap election that just happened, and with some interesting results that came out this morning. So did you stay up all night getting election returns?
I did. And I can't help myself. I'm a bit of an election junkie.
I thought it was the last time we were together for an election.
It's true. It's the first time in a while that I stayed up and was actually pleased with the result. But it's very interesting because, of course, and it's not our main theme today, I know, but Theresa May called this election 6 weeks ago expecting to win in a landslide. And we have a hung parliament. The Conservatives have the largest number of seats, but they don't have enough to form a government. It looks like they're going to have to go into a coalition with the Democratic Unionists from Northern Ireland. And that's
a party which I knew nothing about until this morning.
Yeah, well, it's a party with some worrying associations in history itself, but we're not historians of Ireland, so we'll leave that to our colleagues. So it looks like they'll go into coalition with them to form a government. Whether Theresa May can last, I'm very, very doubtful about that, because this was a real catastrophe for the Conservatives. Yeah. In the Scottish context, there were some interesting developments, because most of our listeners may not know this, but the dominant political party in Scotland for most of the second half of the 20th century, certainly since the war, was the Labour Party. And in recent years, they've been overtaken by the Scottish National Party, which won 56 of 59 seats a few years ago in the 2015 general election. They were never going to maintain that level of support, but the Conservative Party, mm-hmm. the Tories, made a comeback north of the border here in Scotland and actually took seats off
especially in like the Dundee, Aberdeen sort of.
Yeah. And so what's happened is the SNP remained the largest party in Scotland at the moment. But they've been pegged back. I think they lost 21 seats. And the Conservatives are second, and the Labour Party are third, which is really unusual in Scottish, in modern Scottish history. Anyway, it's probably more inside baseball than people wanted, but it's an interesting morning.
Well, I just want to ask you this, because I've been here for 4 years and been through now four big elections here in the UK. One of the things that strikes me is how different elections are run here than they are in the U.S.
In what way?
I like how brief the elections are.
It's quick.
You know, I remember that in the last general election, you know, they only campaigned for like 6 weeks or something, you know, and we campaign in the United States for, sometimes it seems like 6 years for a 4-year term, you know, and people are already thinking about 2020 and 2024 and, you know, and doing that kind of campaign stuff sort of around the clock, where it seems much more condensed here, which I like.
And also the media landscape is different. So by law, all the parties have to be given equal time by the TV networks in terms of party political broadcasts and things like that.
Well, that used to be sort of true in the United States, but that fell apart a while ago.
And that seems to have been a factor in this election. There were only a couple of debates.
Yeah.
Theresa May, the current Prime Minister, at least for the time being,
as of recording time,
refused to participate in the debates, and that might be a decision she regrets. But you're right, it's a condensed period. Mm-hmm. The media, it's not that the media is controlled, but there's a sort of oversight of the media whereby there has to be a notion of fairness in the way things are conducted. The parties release their manifestos, which are like platforms in the U.S., but they do tend to be taken more seriously. I mean, again, May may have made a mistake in making this almost a presidential-style race, and that she tried to pit it as a race between herself and the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. But of course, what we're really electing in the UK are members of Parliament. And so it's 650 contemporaneous local races that are going on, really. And it's not a presidential system, so it's a parliamentary system, and that's a key difference.
Well, if anything, this tells us anything, that shows us the polling is not as good as we thought it was, because this is the third or fourth election, which the polling is not really told us exactly what we thought it was.
Actually, I'm not so sure about that, David. I think the British pollsters got it right this time, because the initial poll 6 weeks ago was showing Labour, the Conservatives ahead by 20 or 25 points.
Yeah.
But those have been narrowing in recent weeks. And there was a poll 2 or 3 days ago that got it spot on. And the exit polling, interestingly, so what one key difference was at 10 o'clock last night, or a key thing to observe is, at 10 o'clock last night when the polls closed, there was an exit poll release that more or less predicted this result and predicted it accurately. Whereas 2 years ago, the exit poll was wrong. So they've obviously done something in terms of their polling. And what was interesting to me about the exit poll was it was jointly sponsored by the BBC, ITV, which is an independent TV network here, Sky News, which is used to be the cousin of Fox News. But basically, different media organizations collaborated on this poll. So everyone had the same exit polling data that they were using. But what was surprising to me was how accurate it proved to be. And in the, I don't know whether you stayed up, but during the broadcast last night, they were saying, you know, the Tories were saying, well, this is an exit poll, we don't know whether it's true or not. But then it quickly was proved to be, well, not quickly, it takes a long time to count the votes.
All right, enough about UK politics. We got a lot of America to talk about. We got two topics today. One, we're going to talk about the Comey hearing, and to talk about sort of the historical antecedents to it. And two, an unusual fight on Twitter, or at least an unexpected matchup on Twitter between Harvard professor Joyce Chaplin and Senator Ted Cruz on the origins of the United States and the importance of international recognition. So those are two big topics.
Yeah, Joyce and Ted's excellent adventure.
Yes. not a matchup I had anticipated discussing this week. All right. So the Comey hearing, did you watch it?
I did. I did. And what I did prior to it, as millions of others did, was I...
You drink heavily?
No, I did not. I read Comey's statement that he released in advance the day before on Wednesday. And it was very interesting to me. I don't know what your views are of it, but I thought, first of all, he's a really good writer has a real sense of drama. So, you know, he can really write a scene. But he...
In a lawyerly way, though, to do both simultaneously make it the... precise and you know, and, but also make it dramatic. Right?
Yes. I mean, he could write fiction.
Yes.
And this is a case where truth is.
Well, he's gotten looking for a job now. So
well, that's right. But I thought his statement set things up, and we knew what was coming because, of course, he's leaked some of this information in advance. But I thought his testimony was incredibly compelling. Because he has a, as I said, a flair for the dramatic, but he also did it, he delivered his testimony in such a measured way that it had more greater impact, I felt, than it would have been if he'd been up there. Well, I didn't expect him to rant and rave, but, you know, he wasn't, there were no histrionics at all in the way he delivered it.
He opened up over the course of the 3 hours. Like, when he first got there, he was almost, you know, robotic in his sort of, you know, stance on the chair. I remember them taking pictures before the hearing started, and he didn't flinch or move a muscle on his, you know, he was a statue. But by the time the thing ended, I think he had opened up a bit in terms of...
Yes, when you say the Lordy, I hope there are tapes. Yes. And things like that. I mean, what was your impression of it, David?
I was deeply impressed by how composed he was. I mean, those are... He looked like he was... I mean, he had bags under his eyes. It looked like he had sort of put lots of thought into preparing for this, but his... you know, he was very eloquent throughout the interrogation. I think it's probably one of the most important congressional testimonies we've ever had in terms of, you know, things that will go down. I mean, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, doesn't that depend
well,
on what happens?
Well, to be sure. But I think in terms of ones that were both highly anticipated and ones that probably have the potential for being, you know, very consequential, I think this is up there.
Okay, well, let's... I mean, we want to go back to the beginning, I know, and talk about the origins of some of these hearings, but with respect to what you just said about it being one of the most significant hearings, what are some of the other highlights in the history of congressional hearings, David?
Well, I mean, these are the obvious ones, you know, are the sort of recent ones. We've got the one that comes to mind with this one is Watergate, but more recently we've got the Iran-Contra hearings. You know, going back earlier, we've got in the 1950s, you've got things like the Army McCarthy hearings, which, you know, I think had, you know, a similar kind of dramatic moment to them. House and American Activities Committee, which is slightly different because they then, you know, what's distinguishing the, all the ones I've just mentioned from the House and American Activities Committees, they were, you know, those were all investigating the executive branch, where the House and American Activities Committees investigating all kinds of people. There's a good political article that sort of looks at some of this and makes the argument that, you know, some of the origins of this goes back to the Teapot Dome scandal in the 1920s, one of these sort of largely forgotten political scandals that was huge in its day. There aren't that many in the 19th century, and I don't think there are any in the, you know, last decade of the 18th century. Probably the most important from the 19th century is the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War during the American Civil War, which was a, you know, an investigatory panel that was formed after Bull Run, or Manassas, as the losers like to call it, although they actually won that battle. You know, a battle that did not go very well for the Union, so Congress forms a committee to investigate why that battle did not go as well as they had hoped it would, and a, you know, commission that goes on to investigate various moments in the war. They are critical, for instance, at Gettysburg, why General Meade didn't fight more aggressively at Gettysburg and pursue Lee after the victory at Gettysburg. They investigate the massacre of Union soldiers at Fort Pillow, and they really serve as a sort of critical congressional sort of counterpoint to the power of the executive in wartime.
Does that committee, David, is it going after the Army and the military, or is it going after Lincoln as the executive, or both?
For the most part, they're doing a bit of both. They very rarely attack Lincoln directly, although they are often attacking military leaders for not behaving properly. They are critical of, you know, those. A lot of the people who are on the committee, and I think it's one of these interesting about these committees, is, you know, Congress as a whole may have a political stance, but oftentimes these committees, which are obviously much smaller, the individual composition of the committee matters. And a lot of people on the Joint Committee during the Civil War were fairly radical Republicans, people who believed in emancipation, people who believed in pursuing the war in a fairly vigorous way, and were critical of generals who didn't. One of the things, though, about the committees is a political, or, you know, it is simultaneously engaging in policy, but it's also engaging in politics. And so sometimes the people they pick fights with because of, you know, their failures in the field. Sometimes they pick fights with people or form alliances with people based on political, you know, legacies that sort of date back from before the war. So in Gettysburg, for instance, one of the people that the Congressional Committee sides with is Daniel Sickles, but that's in part because Sickles had been a congressman before the war, and they had, you know, they saw him as a, you know, a familiar face versus General Meade, who they didn't know as well. So sometimes it's personal and political as much as it is based on policy and based on investigation.
Sure, but these hearings are always political. I mean, yes. They are political theater.
Oh, to be sure. I mean, one of the things about those in the 20th century is, you know, they are very much about speaking to voters, and they are about engaging in politics, and they are about actually investigating, you know, the particulars of you know, whatever it is they're investigating. So if you look back at, you know, the ones in the 20th century, Teapot Dome was one of the first that was covered in radio. I think that's important in terms of why that was an important scandal and the way it was covered and the ways in which congressional committees behave. Obviously, when you get to the 50s and onwards, television is a big part of this. Before we started recording, you mentioned that as a very small child, you grew up watching the Watergate.
I remember the Watergate hearings. That's one of my, I won't say it's one of my earliest memories, but I remember that summer of 1973 watching the Watergate hearings. My mother had them on. Well, they were constantly, they were the only thing on television, really.
Yeah.
She was certainly very agitated about that. very interested, I should say. So it wasn't like she was agitated that the hearings were on. Quite the contrary, very, very interested. And I remember watching them. And the I think the frequency with which they now seem to occur, they're not that, I mean, these are extraordinary events. But they do occur because, or in part because of television. Mm-hmm. So there's a political dimension to this. Comey could have submitted his testimony, I suppose, in writing entirely. And indeed, in a previous century, that might have been the case. But the public dimension of this is really, really important, and the kind of public performance aspect of it is important. Yeah. One thing that struck me when you were kind of running through that list, David, was that of hearings. If you think about the Army McCarthy hearings, if you think about Watergate, and even Iran-Contra, although there may be a slight outlier with regard to what I'm about to say, these are often the beginning of the end for whoever the subject is. It's a very bad sign when you're the subject of a hearing.
Yes.
And we're not...
Although, during the recent past, there were all the Benghazi hearings that went on for, you know, there were dozens of them, and those amounted to, so as far as I can tell, nothing. Although they did probably sink Hillary Clinton's campaign, one could argue.
Well, she lost by such a narrow margin. Who knows what the determining factor was. Yeah. But sure, that was part. Although, I'm not so sure about that, because her testimony, that day when she withstood an entire day of testimony and really made her interrogators look small, was quite a high point for her.
It was, but I think sort of the number of investigations that were happening, the amount of distraction that created from her, you know, core message. And I think a lot of people thought she was guilty of something, even if she did demonstrate.
Okay, but that proves the point I'm making, which is these are the beginning and the end of the subject who's being investigated. And so you said this is one of the, this could be one of the most significant hearings in.
Although they can backfire. The Army McCarthy hearings are the prime example of that, where McCarthy is going after various people.
That's true. And the Army the subject turned on him.
Because, I mean, these can be high stakes, not only for the people who are being questioned and for the topic that's being investigated, but also for the people who are doing the investigation. If they look like they're politicizing what should be a non-political...
You're right. I should have clarified that. I mean, the Army McCarthy hearings were at the beginning and the end for McCarthy.
McCarthy, yeah.
Not for the Army.
Yeah, the Army is still around, as far as I know.
But what I mean is these are big moments, and the stakes are very high. And it seemed to me that Comey came across, and Comey's a problematic figure because of his intervention in the election last autumn. He's problematic in a lot of ways, but Comey came across as measured and credible, and that's a problem for Donald Trump. Yeah.
The only person, most of the senators behaved themselves. The one that baffled me, and probably baffled you too, was John McCain's behavior.
Yes.
But I'm not quite sure what to make. I'm not even sure he's on that committee. I think he just asked to...
just wandered in.
Well, if he was on the committee, he would have been seated higher up.
Yeah,
so I think he was just like an invited guest. I'm not quite sure I understood his questions.
I'm not sure Comey understood his questions. I don't know what he was trying to... it was a bad day for Trump. It was a worse day for President Trump.
Trump, to be sure.
And one thing I would say is if we're providing some historical context... It's very, very unusual in both the UK and the US to call an office holder a liar.
Yeah.
And although Comey didn't come out and say it in quite those terms, he did not say it.
Yeah.
I mean, the implication was, and then the front page of the New York Daily News this morning said liar.
Yeah.
I mean, Comey basically called Donald Trump a liar.
And Trump just called Comey a liar on Twitter. So
But historically calling somebody a liar, that is a talk about a trigger word.
Right,
I mean, that literally a trigger word in the sense that it would result in a duel. If you called somebody a liar in the late 18th or early 19th century in public, you would have to shoot them.
and that in some ways is the origin of the Senate rule that you can't be critical of another senator is because Pitchfork Ben Tillman almost killed somebody as a consequence of
Right, I mean, there's a line, and liar is beyond that line historically. Yeah. Now, of course, there was the guy who shouted liar at who was that, the South Carolina
Was it Joe Wilson who said it?
During the State of the Union, one of Obama's State of the Union addresses. Yeah. But again, that was seen as being what was impropriety. So the use of this word liar is very interesting, and that did come up yesterday. Mm-hmm. And as you say, and now Trump has responded accordingly. So I don't think it's the last hearing we're going to have.
Oh, no. So either.
But the evidence that Comey presented seemed compelling, and he seemed credible.
Yeah. But thinking about the political theater of it, I went to actually a Comey hearing watching party yesterday.
Why you didn't make it through the election last night.
We were watching, and you know, there were plenty of questions where, you know, Comey responded, "Well, I can't answer that. I'll mention this in closed session." And I remember one of the people at the party said, "Well, why are they asking these questions? They know we can't answer." And it's in large part, it's because of the political theater of it. You need to ask the questions. You know, asking the question is as important, sometimes as important as what the answer is, or the questions he can't answer because they touch on classified information or ongoing investigations or what have you.
But it also tells the public, has the same question in their mind
that Congress is, that the senators are. Holding the feet to the fire, as it were. So,
well, I think this one is going to run and run, and we'll probably be returning to it.
Yes, I have no doubt that we're going to be coming back to sort of shades of this question later on. All right, our second topic was sort of a strange one, and it came out of the U.S. President Trump's decision to exit the Paris Climate Accord, and in the aftermath of that, Joyce Chaplin, who's a very distinguished professor at Harvard. I think she's chair of the American Studies Department there.
American Civilization, I think.
American Civilization. I'm sorry, because Harvard does things their own way. She said, and I'm just going to make sure I make
She's a very, very eminent historian of early America, and particularly
in
the history of science.
Yes. So I just want to make sure I read her quotes correctly. She tweeted, "The USA created by international community in the Treaty of Paris in 1783 betrays international community by withdrawing from hashtag Paris Climate Agreement today."
Right, and I remember she tweeted that after Trump made his statement about that.
Yeah.
If memory serves, I retweeted it because I thought, oh, Joyce is absolutely right about that. That's very interesting, and the irony of the United States, American independence was recognized by the Peace of Paris in 1783 and repudiating another.
So there was some polite sort of discussion about the merits of this particular statement and what it meant and all these other kinds of things. And then about 10 hours later, I think this is when things started to get weird, when Senator Ted Cruz,
Republican of Texas.
Yes. said, "Just sad." I guess he's getting tweeting lessons from the president. "Just sad. Tenured professor at Harvard doesn't seem to know how USA was created. Not a treaty. Declaration plus Revolutionary War plus Constitution equals USA. Joyce, in response, decided to tweet back at the senator. She said, I guess she's mocking him here. "Sad, U.S. Senator, Harvard law degree, doesn't know that national statehood requires international recognition." And going back at this, the senator replied, "Lefty academics at my alma mater think USA was created by the international community. No, USA created by force, the blood of patriots, and we the people." All right, so this is your bailiwick. If you're going to pick when the United States was created, Frank, which date are you going to pick?
No, and he did follow up.
Oh, okay.
Because he also tweeted, "Treaty of Paris simply memorialized that fact of our total victory at Yorktown. Her claim is like saying a plastic globe created the Earth."
Which doesn't. Okay.
Yep,
anyway. Okay. So, Frank, what date do you pick for when the United States was created?
Well.
Are you going to side with Senator Cruz, or are you going to side with?
No, I'm definitely siding with Joyce Chaplin. But.
For no other reason that we're never going to agree with Senator Cruz on
that. That's right. And I have a lot of respect for Joyce and her work, but it's not that. She happens to be right. I mean, the United States declared its independence on, and actually declared independence formally, it voted on independence on July 2nd, 1776. It adopted the Declaration of Independence, making that decision known to the world on the 4th of July.
Didn't John Adams say something about, like, in future days, like, Americans will celebrate the 2nd of July as our great national holiday?
He said, yes, we'll celebrate it with fireworks and ringing bells and things like this.
And he was wrong about lots of things.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. John Adams is not a very good predictor of the future. And so one could argue that the Declaration of Independence created the United States. Mm. Of course, had the American rebels lost the War of Independence, mm-hmm. then the Declaration of Independence is forgotten. Yeah. And the Declaration of Independence is a very interesting document because among the phrases that it contains is Jefferson, as the primary author, references the fact that it's necessary to make this declaration because of a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Yeah. And so there's a degree to which the Declaration of Independence is intended to be an international document, proclaiming mm-hmm. to what we now call the international community, whatever that means, that this new entity, the United States, exists. And Joyce Chaplin's argument, I think, in this, I mean, it's a tweet, so let's not read too much into it. Her point is, and this seems to be, if I can use the language of the Declaration, self-evident, is that it's only with the recognition of the international community, which occurs in 1783 at the end of the War of Independence, that the United States comes into being. Or that it's the recognition makes it so. And given that the Declaration was intended, as I said a moment ago, for the international community, there's certainly merit to what she has to say.
Yeah.
Now, if there's no Declaration of Independence, if there's no War of Independence that's successful for the American rebels, then there's no treaty ending it that recognizes the United States. Senator Cruz's response is interesting in a number of ways. He's not wrong that the things he listed, the Declaration of Independence, the War of Independence, and Frank, the Constitution that consolidates the Revolution, are important.
He doesn't mention the Articles of Confederation.
No, he doesn't. Joyce Chaplin knows that, yes. She's smart. But her point was in response to the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. Mm. Look, the international community is important. Mm. The United States is its very being was created through the recognition of the international community, and therefore I think she was commenting on the irony that the United States was turning its back on the international community. Ted Cruz, in his interpretation, takes that, and I think he's making two points. One is he's attacking liberal academics, or lefty academics at his alma mater, as he said. So he's using this as a pretext, not just to attack Joyce Chaplin, but also, he says, academics. He says it's an attack on liberal academics. Mm. And this is a trope that has a great deal of resonance with the right in the United States right now. And so he was pandering to that. And he was pandering to a kind of a very interesting, and I would actually argue a slightly disturbing, nationalism.
Yeah.
So he talks about, as you said, and let me get the quote right, not a treaty, declaration plus Revolutionary War plus Constitution equals USA. So he's reduced it to a mathematical formula. But then his follow-up, okay, so the tweet that I think is really significant is, lefty academics at my alma mater think the USA... All right, so first he's getting in that. Yeah, lefty academics at my alma mater, Ivy League academic, created by international community. So he's turning this, he's saying it's the international community is the problem, which of course the Trump administration is turning away from. Mm. Then he says, no, USA created by force, the blood of patriots, and we the people. And I think this language, this appeal to blood.
Yeah.
Now, he's not appealing to blood in a kind of ethnocentric way, but he's not a million miles away from that.
Yeah.
And this language of the people is populist. And he's basically saying the U.S. is created through violence, which it is. Mm. But the international community doesn't matter. They go to hell, international community. So he's telling lefty academics to go to hell, and he's telling the international community to go to hell.
Yeah, there's an American exceptionalist sort of element to all this, where what matters is not what the rest of the world thinks about us, it's what we think about ourselves.
Right.
That the rest of the world can go to hell. You know, thinking about this in the context of you know, period I study, you know, the Confederacy declares its independence from the United States, starting with South Carolina in December of 1860 and followed by its southern brethren, you know, shortly thereafter. But they never get international recognition, which is something they desperately, desperately want. And, you know,
because they need it not just kind of for war material, but it actually matters.
It matters tremendously in terms of the mechanics of the war, but it also matters in terms of the legitimacy of their government as a government. And one of the things the Lincoln administration is very sure to do, especially early in the war, but really throughout the war, is saying we're not going to recognize the Confederacy as a legitimate government. We recognize there are states that are in rebellion and there's, you know, an insurrection going on, and we'll fight a war to end the insurrection, but that the Confederacy itself does not exist. You know, and they jump through some pretty massive hoops to make sure that they don't recognize Confederate legitimacy, especially in the first half of the war.
And international recognition is essential for all countries that declare independence or become independent.
You know, and the bit where he, you know, the United States getting international recognition was fundamental to its victory in the Revolution. The United States would not have won at Yorktown were it not for the French. And you know, it's not the sacrifice of patriots, the sacrifice of patriots and French allies and other people that made independence possible.
That's right. And indeed, one of the reasons for the Declaration of Independence wasn't just so that the patriots could declare independence.
Yeah.
It was also so that they could appeal to the French for external assistance and recognition. So they get it from the French, they get it from the Dutch. So during the war, they depend on international recognition and support, but they also need to compel Britain to accept their independence.
I mean, one can make an argument based on, and I'm going to put words in Ted Cruz's mouth now, because why not, that if Ted Cruz's model of how states are formed works, then ISIS is the legitimate government.
Right, because they've declared themselves, they've declared a caliphate.
And they've got a capital, and they've got a military, and they kill people, and they have lots of blood, and so if what makes the United States is force and blood of patriots, the same argument you made for saying ISIS is legitimate government. I don't think Ted Cruz wants to go down that road intellectually.
So, yes, I mean, international recognition is essential within the global order. And that was the point Joyce was making. I think it's an entirely valid point. Right. I mean, you began by saying, okay, at what point does the United States, is it created? Well, and that's not a, I mean, and you know this, it's not a simple answer.
Yes.
But certainly at the point, one can plausibly argue that the three really important moments in terms of, if you want dates, are 1776, when...
1763
is really
important. French and Indian Wars. Also, Paris is the best place for conferences.
1776 with the Declaration of Independence, 1783 with the end of the war and the recognition of the United States by Britain, accepting the independence of the United States, and 87 or 89 with the ratification of the Constitution, which creates the and consolidates the outcome of the war, of the Revolution. And of course, the three are related. You can't have any of the, you couldn't have any of those dates without the other. This kind of reductionist self-creation myth that Ted Cruz is proposing just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Well,
except if you're a Ted Cruz fan,
right? It doesn't make historical sense. It makes political sense. He's attacking lefty academics.
Yeah.
And he's attacking people who think that the international community matters, and he's very much kind of endorsing a kind of America is first and foremost and all important.
Yeah. All right. So Ted Cruz is wrong. What else did he do? All right.
Yeah.
I guess it's time for our last drop, Frank. What do you got?
I want to endorse Bob Dylan's Nobel lecture, which he released. I mean, this was a big week for people releasing things. So we had Comey's statement before this, which was very well written. And a couple days before that, Bob Dylan, who of course was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature last year, and there was a kind of time limit. I think June 10th is the deadline by which he had to give his lecture. As one
or,
of the
or else what? Like the Nobel Prize turns into a pumpkin or something?
No, he wouldn't get the money.
Money, oh. Okay. So Bob Dylan needs the money.
Well, he got about $900,000, I think, for it. So, Dylan released his Nobel lecture, both in, it was released in written form and an audio, and by an audio recording. It's extraordinary. It's very well written.
Is it available on vinyl?
I'm sure it will be. It's available on YouTube, and I strongly recommend you listen to it, because it's not Bob Dylan being gnomic and mocking. Mm. He's playing it straight. He gives the lecture. He talks about his musical influences. He talks about his literary influences. Mm. The three books he talks about at some length are All Quiet on the Western Front, Moby Dick, and The Odyssey.
Hmm.
And he does so in a kind of quite personal way. There's a strange element to it, because he explains what these books are about as though people hadn't heard of them, which is a little odd. And he also talks about his musical influences. So he opens with this comment about seeing Buddy Holly when he, that is Bob Dylan, was a teenager. It's really, really worth listening to, and okay. I would strongly recommend it. It's 27 minutes okay. long.
Well, so. I was deeply impressed when I read it. He wrote this autobiography, I guess, Chronicles Volume yep. 1 a few years ago, when it was, you know, most rock star autobiographies are nonsense and written by a ghostwriter. This one actually had some intellectual merit to it. So
he's not stupid.
No, he's sometimes a little bit inarticulate in terms of trying to figure out what the lyrics mean, but... Yeah, no, I'll have to listen to that over the weekend.
Yeah, please do. And David, what's your last drop?
I want to endorse a hashtag. The hashtag is I Look Like a Historian, which looks like it came out of the Big Berks conference. The Berkshire conference is a conference of women and gender historians that meets every 3 years. And I guess it just met last weekend in, I think they were in Rutgers. Is that right? I think they're in Rutgers. But the hashtag is in response, basically, to this sort of supposition that historians are middle-aged white guys in button-down shirts. If you sort of do a Google image search for historian, that people look like...
You mean like us.
Exactly. Usually with slightly more gray hair than I have, but men between the ages of, you know, 40 and 70, which is...
Like both. Us.
All right, usually with some, you know, bookshelves behind us or some other kind of, you know, intellectual prop. But the purpose of the hashtag is sort of demonstrate sort of the diversity within the historical profession, especially among women, especially among people of color, among people who are engaging in historical work outside of academia, to sort of recognize the diversity of the profession. What it means to be a historian doesn't necessarily mean you're a middle-aged white guy with a bookshelf. So I want to endorse the hashtag I Look Like a Historian.
Okay.
Great. Till next time, Frank.
David, have a good weekend.
Cheers.
Cheers.